Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. This week we're off to the World Cup in Spain 1982 as Northern Ireland look to repeat their heroics of that famous team from 1958. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. Now, the World Cup in Spain 1982 was where Northern Ireland were headed to, but how would they do? No wins for the team as they headed to the World Cup. A young man by the name of Norman Whiteside was only 17, and what's more, they'd been drawn in the same group as hosts Spain. But could Billy Bingham conjure some more magic with this team? And so, Gary, what do we have to look forward to in today's podcast?
Yeah, so it's I suppose it's the build-up to the World Cup finals in 1982. It was Northern Ireland's second ever World Cup, the first since 1958. And obviously with all the excitement, all the hype about a sold-out Windsor Park and qualifying at home with Gerry Armstrong's goal against Israel, I suppose we can do the build-up. And it was, I suppose, very different in those days. It was difficult to get matches. And Billy Bingham was scraping around trying to organise warm-up matches. Obviously, the three home championship games, which were obviously used as a warm-up, but it was quite difficult to get other games. And I suppose the preparation didn't go very well, but obviously it was all right on the night, as they say.
You said it was difficult to kind of find friendlies. Was that because it was difficult to just to find the nations to come to Windsor or to go there? Or what? Why was it difficult, I suppose, at the time to find different nations?
Yeah, just even general. I mean, there was talk, actually, that Northern Ireland were going to go to the United States and play games over there. But that never materialized. In the end, they got a bit lucky because France had arranged a glamour friendly in Paris against England in March 82. And then when the draw was made, they came out in the same group. So they cancelled that, and quick as a flash, the IFA or Billy Bingham were in and said, hey, we'll play us instead. We'll come to Paris. So that was obviously going to be a huge test and a very tough game, but Billy Bingham wanted that for his players. He wasn't able to arrange another match. He tried, and there was newspaper reports talking about various options and things being explored, but in the end, apart from the three home championship games, they were the only warm ups. And in the end, we'll go on and talk about the week in Brighton, which was effectively their warm up for the World Cup.
Yeah, it's quite a strange one. We'll get on to that, but I suppose let's start about the British Home Championship. They've got to go to Wembley again, but no heroics this time round.
No, so I mean, Northern Ireland had won the home championship, as right. We talked about in the past, in 1980. And technically, they were still the reigning champions because in 1981, England and Wales didn't travel to Belfast. The games got cancelled over the political situation in Northern Ireland at the time. So it wasn't deemed safe. The games were cancelled. So the 81 home championship was effectively scrapped. So 82, thankfully, everything was back on track. And in February 82, Northern Ireland travelled to Wembley, and in front of 55,000 people were frankly outplayed, outclassed. The British press, the newspapers were not very complimentary. It wasn't looking good for the World Cup, if that's the performance. I mean, Brian Robson had England a goal up after in the first minute. I mean, if you look at the names of the goal scorers, you have the likes of Kevin Keegan, Ray Wilkins, Glenn Hoddle, top footballers. Northern Ireland were totally outclassed. It wasn't a good performance. And I suppose it was a bit worrying to take such a hammering. And Malcolm Brodie was concerned as well. We talked about Malcolm Brodie in the past. I mean, he was probably the doyen. I mean, he was the expert on football in Northern Ireland, having been to every game since 1946. But even one of the doyens of journalism across the globe, football journalism, not to mind just in Northern Ireland. So, but he always called it as it is. He wasn't sugarcoating anything. And Wembley was a 4-0 tanking. They were seen as being out of their depth and being very concerned. for what was to come in Spain.
Yeah, and that international friendly, as you mentioned, then happens in March 1982, and, well, it doesn't get much better either, does it?
No, I mean, it was another 4-0 tanking by the French. Now, it has to be said, it was an incredibly talented French side, as they were going to go on and show in Spain as well. Mm. And I mean, that was the French side that actually had knocked out the Republic of Ireland in qualifying, albeit on goal difference, actually. But it was a very talented French side. They blew Northern Ireland away in March 82. It was 4-0. Again, Malcolm Brody didn't sugarcoat anything in the press, and it was concerning. Pat Jennings, if I recall, missed the game. Jim Platt was in goal, but it didn't make any difference. They were totally outclassed, and it was very, very worrying times with a World Cup and Northern Ireland being on the world stage.
Absolutely, yeah, and Scotland's comes to Belfast then, perhaps offering a glimmer of hope that perhaps things weren't as bad as it seemed.
Yeah, so it was an interesting one. Billy decided to experiment with Scotland in town for the British Championship. So possibly one of the greatest Glentoran players of all time, Jim Cleary, beautiful midfielder, so good on the ball. So he got a first cap. Felix Healy started, well, a very proud Derry man and a star with Derry City afterwards, but he was with Coleraine at the time. Derry City weren't even in senior football. And Felix, a very, very talented player as well. He got to start, and he brought a striker from Bradford City by the name of Bobby Campbell, who had been banned for 7 years by the IFA for something that happened at a youth tournament when he was a young lad. And but he'd served his ban, and he came from nowhere into the team. And all three actually ended up in the squad for Spain. And they all did themselves justice. I mean, Scotland were also on their way to the World Cup. Jock Stein had a very, very talented squad. Scotland were expected to make an impact. They had the disappointment of Argentina 78 when they had nearly won the tournament before they left home. And, of course, they suffered an embarrassing exit, losing to Peru, drawing with Iran. And despite a brilliant win over the Dutch, they were eliminated in the group stage, but they were expected to be a lot better in Spain. They took the lead through John Wark in the first half, but Sammy McElroy just after the break equalised, and it was seen as being a very creditable draw for Northern Ireland. Very good performance. The crowd went home happy, and the experiment was seen to have worked, and a few people put their hands up for a spot on the plane to Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose if you're a manager, any manager, when you're bringing new faces into a squad, you want to see, well, show me how much you want this. And it looks like those players duly performed that, and maybe kind of gave them a little bit of, as we kind of talked about with the Republic of Ireland, sometimes you need a couple of fresh faces to, you know, just reinvigorate the squad, maybe get more energy into the team, and it seems to have worked a little against Scotland.
But there was a lot going on in the background. I think you need to give some context at the time as well, because in 1982, Argentina had invaded the Falkland Islands, and basically Britain went to war with Argentina. And there was actually serious talk of the three home nations that had qualified, England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, having to boycott the World Cup. In fact, the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association in Scotland, Harry Lowry, who was their representative, actually called for a boycott of the World Cup. And his equivalent in the PFA in England, Alan Gowling, who was, people of my vintage may remember him as a very talented, I'm conscious that might be a lot of younger people listening, but Alan Gowling was a very talented footballer with Newcastle, and he certainly rubbished it from the player's point of view, and or from the English player's point of view anyway, and certainly the IFA didn't seem so keen on it. But it was brought up, but the British government were quite happy that there would be no boycott and that they should go. The English FA did express a concern that they didn't want to play Argentina if they were to draw Argentina in the World Cup. Now, the draw was made, so luckily nobody had drawn Argentina. But there was a concern they could meet them in the later rounds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I strongly suspect Northern Ireland absolutely had no intention of not going to their first World Cup since 1958. No matter the story behind whatever they've been asked to do, I think they would have been going head, heel, or toe.
Look, England or Scotland have never boycotted a World Cup either, but it was certainly in the case of England, they could see there was another one to come in 4 years. I mean, they don't come around very often for the smaller nations. And yeah, it would have been a huge blow for Northern Ireland if they had to boycott it. But fortunately, they didn't, and they didn't have to do that.
Yeah,
but that would have been a really difficult situation.
Scotland did refuse to go to a couple of World Cups, as we've discussed in the podcast before, because didn't feel like it was right because they didn't win the British Home Nations Tournament, so they decided to not go to a World Cup. So Home Nations Championship, England beat Northern Ireland 4-0. They draw 1-1 with Scotland, and now they've got to go away to Wales in Wrexham. And if there was a glimmer of hope that things might not be so bad against Scotland, it was soon extinguished in Wrexham.
Yeah, I mean, Malcolm Brodie described this as the worst ever performance.
Wow.
Now, as I said, he's been going since 1946, and we talked before about some heavy defeats. So this was the worst he saw. This was the worst ever. Now, it wasn't. It was played in front of the smallest crowd at the time to ever watch an international match in Great Britain, 2,315 people. Some of us have actually seen Northern Ireland play Wales in front of a smaller crowd, because if we digress to the famous Carling Cup in 2011, I think the attendance was 539.
Ooh.
At the Aviva Stadium for Northern Ireland and Wales in what was a dead match. And in 1982 in Wrexham, it was 2,315 people, and it wasn't good. Wales won 3-0. They absolutely battered Northern Ireland. I mean, if you look at the names of the goal scorers, you have the likes of Alan Curtis, Ian Rush, Peter Nicholas, some really talented players. So there were a lot of very good players on view, but it was a game to forget for Northern Ireland. And Malcolm Brodie was very concerned about the World Cup after that performance and that result. And that was the last game. It wasn't possible to organise any other matches. So it was, a few days in Brighton in the University of Sussex was the preparation for Spain.
Wow. Yeah, so they've gone from the super highs of that 1-0 win over Israel in November 1981. February, March, April, May, didn't win an international, big concern, hammered by England, France and Wales. So you'd have to wonder that there must have been some sort of, I don't know, sit down or get together or something where you'd imagine they'd have all had to sit down and go, hey, hold on a second here, we're going to a World Cup in a month's time, we need to do something. So do we know kind of what happens when they do go to Brighton?
Yeah, so Billy Bingham brought them to Brighton, so they stayed on the seafront in the Metropole Hotel, and they were using the University of Sussex facilities, which in 1982, from all accounts, were basic enough. The big advantage was it was 25 degrees on the south coast, and Brighton was actually hotter than Barcelona for when they were there. So it was used to acclimatise. Now, we've talked before about the team spirit in that squad. Billy Bingham, certainly as a manager, getting the best out of them.
Mm.
And it's clear that, look, everyone came together And I mean, it's easy to look back in hindsight as well and look at how talented that England team, that French team, and even that Welsh team that beat them. They were really, really good sides with some really, really top players. I mean, Ian Rush was one of the greatest strikers of all time.
Yeah.
Probably the greatest Liverpool striker of all time. And I say that with the height of respect for the players that have played in recent years. Again, I'm showing my age, but you had some really top players in all those teams. That French team, the likes of Platini, Rochetteau, Larios, those names still trip off the tongue. Marius Tresor, Manuel Amoros. There were some really, really top players in that French team as well, as Northern Ireland were going to find out again. But certainly the week in Brighton, it helped a lot, got the squad together. They had their warm weather training, and then it was off to Spain. So Northern Ireland were actually based in Valencia, even though two of the games were being played up in Zaragoza, which was about, in those days, and probably even still today, was about 5 or 6 hours away by road. So for those whose Spanish geography, Valencia is down on the east coast, quite south, and Zaragoza is inland between Barcelona and, let's say, Bilbao. It's on the way. So it was a bit of travelling for the fans as well. But the team travelled up to Zaragoza for the two games.
Yeah, so they're after the World Cup. They go, they get there. They're obviously prepping. With what's happened in the results previous, are the fans, and I suppose generally speaking, are they there more in hope than expectation that they get the kind of performances that obviously you want to see as a fan in a major tournament?
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say they were travelling more in hope than expectation. I mean, Northern Ireland had drawn the host Spain, which was always going to be a very tough, if not impossible, task. And they'd drawn a very, very talented Yugoslavia side. And the fourth team in the group were the Minnows from Honduras. There wasn't too much known about them at the time, but they were being seen as expected to be the group whipping boys, but didn't quite turn out like that. But there wasn't much known about the Central American side. And I think it was the first World Cup, if I remember correctly. And they weren't expected to make too much of an impact.
Talk to us about the format as well before we go on, because I didn't know this, but it's a group into a group and then into playoffs. I never knew that was a thing.
So the World Cup, when I say they were always 16, they were, that's not quite correct. There was only 13 in 1950 and something similar, I think, in 1930. But the design of the previous tournaments up to including 1978 was a 16-team tournament, four groups of four. Now, in 74, actually, they did go on to play another group, but typically it went to quarterfinals. 78 actually was also in two groups. So in 74 and 78, they'd gone to groups. Whereas if you go back to 1970 to 1966, it went straight knockout from the quarterfinals on. But in 74 and 78, it went from 16 to 8. So there were two groups of four, and then that would produce the two finalists, as in 78, where Argentina and the Dutch won the two mini groups. So for 1982, the World Cup went to 24 teams, and they decided to stick with that format. So they went from six groups of four teams. The top two in each group qualified for the second phase. So in the second phase, there were four groups of three teams, and each of the winners of those mini groups would go on to the semi-final. You had to finish in the top two of your one of your groups to get to the next phase, to get to the knockout, but was actually another mini group. But so if you qualified out of your group, you were guaranteed another two matches. It was very convoluted, and it obviously meant there was always a team idle And in some cases, you might have had to wait around if you played your two games for the other two teams to meet to see if you got onto the semi-final or you went home. So it wasn't a very good system, and they actually dispensed with it. They never used it again. This was the only World Cup that they used these four small groups of three, and I can see why it was only done once.
I just listened to you explaining this, and it just seems utterly pointless, the utterly pointlessness of having so many group phases to a tournament instead of just simply group phase knockout and you're done. You don't need to complicate anything. That's weird. So for this World Cup, we're into a group. Top two goes into the next phase, which is another group, and then the top one in that group gets into the playoffs.
The top one gets into the semi-final then.
Okay.
Yeah. So Northern Ireland were in group five or group E. I think it was actually used by numbers. Yeah, but they were in a group with Spain, the hosts, and Spain decided to play all their games in Valencia. And the other three games in the group were played in Zaragoza. And you can forgive my Spanish pronunciation because I'm murdering both of those names. In fact, it's actually Valencia, or Valencia. I'm not going to even try. I'm just going to stick with our English badly pronounced names.
Phonetics.
And everybody will know what I mean. The group kicked off in Valencia with Spain at home to Honduras, and it wasn't the easy win that everyone expected. Honduras actually took an early lead, and Spain didn't equalize until they got a penalty midway through the second half, and it was a very disappointing start for Spain and an incredible start for Honduras to get a one-all draw against the hosts, which caused quite a stir.
Yugoslavia against Northern Ireland, then this is the first match for Northern Ireland in the World Cup. This is a really good Yugoslavia team, always to be worried about. How does this match go?
Yeah, so they were dark horses for the World Cup. I mean, it was Yugoslavia then, but if you're thinking modern day, that includes Serbia, Croatia, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Kosovo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. I mean, and they all played as one nation in Yugoslavia, and they had some incredibly talented players. They were firm favourites, and there wasn't a lot to report in the game, but Northern Ireland played incredibly well. David McCreary was the star player. And Billy Bingham sprung a surprise. He decided to play a 17-year-old by the name of Norman Whiteside, who broke the record, a record which he still retains as being the youngest player to ever play in a World Cup finals. The record previously belonged to a Brazilian bloke by the name of Pelé, who some of you may have heard of. So Norman Whiteside took his record, and he played incredibly well as well. And he was earmarked even after that game as being a star for the future. And certainly he was a find for Northern Ireland in that World Cup. He had impressed in Brighton during the week, and Billy Bingham decided to throw him in. And Malcolm Brodie changed his tune very quickly in the Belfast Telegraph. This was a fantastic performance. It was a fantastic result. They talked about there was 1,500 Northern Ireland fans there. And I suppose you put that in context, it wasn't that easy to travel to Spain, a lot more expensive in those days. So only 1,500 fans were apparently there to support Northern Ireland, including the MP, Harold McCusker, who was an Armagh MP. So he was there with the fans, and the Minister for Sport, the UK Minister for Sport, was sitting in the VIP box. So there's a bit of a contrast there, although I'm sure it doesn't do a politician any harm to show himself to be a man of the people and to be standing behind the goal with the fans as opposed to hobnobbing it with the prawn sandwiches in the VIP box.
you get more votes with the plebs and the cheap seats. I'd imagine.
I think you do. I think you do. A smart move. You know. So.
But no, it's fantastic. And just on that kind of that Norman Whiteside kind of theme that you're talking about there, we gave a lot of plaudits in the last podcast to Billy Bingham and his ability, and but he could spot talent as well. I mean, he didn't have Norman Whiteside for very long, but he could see that this kid had something, and to stick him in, you know, into such a huge stage and to see him play so well, and then, you know, for Billy to have faith in him to do that at such a young age, it's really quite incredible. And you have to admit, quite brave of Billy to kind of make that kind of decision after, you know, this huge build-up to a World Cup.
Yeah, it was. I mean, to throw in a 17-year-old into a World Cup finals was incredibly brave. Now, it was obviously quite brave with the Brazilian manager in 1958 as well. But it was incredibly brave. And Norman Whiteside obviously went on to be a top, top player. And unfortunately, his career was cut short in his mid-20s by a bad injury. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even though his career was cut short, what a career he did have and what a player he was. But as you say, incredibly, incredibly brave by Billy Bingham. And probably born out of some of the results in the warm-up, maybe he thought he'd nothing to lose at this stage, that the games hadn't gone as well as expected. And why not take a chance and throw him in?
Yeah, and he was probably more convinced of that after the Scotland game, where he did make those kind of changes and brought in those new faces that perhaps maybe people didn't expect him to do. And he got a 1-1 draw with Scotland. And here again, he is sticking in, you know, perhaps a player that people, the opposition as well, you know, might not have been familiar with too. So it gives you a bit of an extra edge, an unknown quantity type of thing. And it was fantastic of him to do that. So it's a 0-0 draw. And more importantly then for Northern Ireland, it's a point on the board.
Yeah, a point on the board, and the group was all level. Everybody had 1 point on the board after two matches. And again, I suppose the advantage for Northern Ireland and for Honduras was they get to see Spain play Yugoslavia the night before they get to meet. And this time the hosts, this was actually a cracking game of football. I remember watching it on TV, and Yugoslavia took a very early lead, but Spain came back, they got another penalty and equalized, and they got the winner in the second half. And there was certainly a suspicion that Spain were getting the benefit of the doubt from the referees, and there was a feeling that a lot of hometown decisions in those days in the World Cup, but it was a huge win for Spain and left them in very good shape, and left Yugoslavia struggling in the group on 1 point. And so now Northern Ireland had a fantastic opportunity to join Spain on 3 points when they faced Honduras in Zaragoza the following night.
It's an interesting game, an interesting result. I suppose, well, let's talk about the game first of all. How does the game go for Northern Ireland?
So it starts off very well. They have a penalty shout that Norman Whiteside was convinced was a penalty, but it was given as a free kick outside the box. But no matter, it was played in, and I think it was Chris Nicol headed it on, and Gerry Armstrong from 6 inches finished the ball for the net. And I remember the RT panel, I think it was Liam Toohey or someone, I could be doing that wrong, but said, oh, Gerry's always deadly from 6 inches. But it's a line that's always stuck with me. But it was a fantastic start. And at stage, it was expected to go on and win the game. 1-0 up 10 minutes. The minnows of the group, right, they had a fantastic result against Spain, but it didn't work out like that. And actually Malcolm Brodie was quite critical of Billy Bingham's tactics. He decided Northern Ireland were too defensive, and instead of taking the game by the jugular and going for the second one, they seemed to sit back. There was a warning when Bentancur, I think, hit the crossbar for Honduras, and they brought on a substitute, Lang, midway through the second half, and he got an equaliser that they probably deserved. It was quite disappointing. And the game finished 1-1, and it was seen, the reports in the Belfast Telegraph, is a miracle is now needed. And I think wrongly, because I can't see this from looking at the group, but they decided Northern Ireland needed a big win over Spain. Now, I can't see any scenario at that stage where anything for a win over Spain would have denied Northern Ireland a place in the knockouts. So I think the telly got that one wrong. But certainly it was kind of an impossible task to go to Valencia and beat the hosts, which that certainly was needed, or Northern Ireland would have been heading home from the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. But often, as in Republic of Ireland history as well, when the chips seem stacked against you, there's always someone who comes up to be the hero on the day. So I suppose let's move on then to, so it's the last matches of this group stage. Yugoslavia inflict a loss on Honduras. That's their only loss in this World Cup as well. And they need a bit of a late show to do it as well.
Yeah, so I think there's something that needs to be pointed out, that, and this was the last time it happened in a World Cup, and not because of the events in Zaragoza and Valencia, but the events in Gijon. But so Honduras were actually playing Yugoslavia the night before. So the last games of the group did not kick off at the same time. And so Yugoslavia beat Honduras 1-0. Vladimir Petrovic, who was the star of that team, he scored the only goal from the penalty spot. It was a late goal, actually. Honduras certainly acquitted themselves very well in that tournament. He was actually ended up playing for Arsenal. I think he was already signed for Arsenal at that stage in the World Cup. And there weren't too many foreign players going into the English game at that stage. Mm-hmm. So that left Yugoslavia on 3 points, Spain on 3 points, Honduras finished their campaign on 2 points, and Northern Ireland on 2 points. And because of the goal difference, Northern Ireland would have needed, I think, a 1-1 draw that could have ended up drawing lots, or a 2-2 draw to go through, or a win, obviously, would top the group. But they had to play Spain in front of a sold-out crowd in Valencia. Now, I should point out the crowds in Zaragoza. There was only 15,000 in a stadium that held over 40,000 at the Honduras game and only 25,000 at the Yugoslavia game. So for a lot of those games in that World Cup, you could rock up on the day and buy a ticket. And it was only for the big games with Spain, etc., that they were actually sold out.
So it's a huge, huge game for both teams in front of 49,500 people in Valencia. I suppose when you looked at it from a Northern Ireland point of view, was there any hope that this was going to be some sort of miracle in the air?
Yeah, but it was seen as being a really tall order, as a bit of a miracle. I mean, the other thing is, there was a prize. So Spain were effectively through. It would have taken a 2-goal defeat to put them out. But if they drew or won, they would have topped the group and would have had a much easier second round group, because the group runners up were going to end up in the same group as England and West Germany. That would have been seen as an incredibly tough second round group. There, England and Germany, the Germans at the time, would have been two of the favourites for the tournament. So Spain certainly didn't want to finish runners up. They were in front of their home crowd in Valencia, and they wanted to put on a show and win the game and top the group and move on to Madrid.
Yeah, they certainly did, but that is not what happened. What did happen was probably, arguably, not just simply one of the greatest results of Northern Ireland football history, but probably in World Cup history. If we're being honest, it is a massive upset. And it is an incredible performance by Northern Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is one of the great World Cup shocks of all time for the hosts to be beaten like that at home in front of their own crowd. And certainly there was feelings in Northern Ireland. They didn't get a rub of the green from the referee either. He did them absolutely no favours. They got to half-time 0-0, defended very well, backs to the wall, but also caused the Spanish problems. And just into the second half, Billy Hamilton got away down the right-hand side, and he put a cross in, and as the commentator said, it's Hamilton Arcanada, the Spanish keeper. He dived full length, but he only parried the ball out, and it was Arcanada Armstrong, because Jerry Armstrong was there to drive the ball into the net to score probably the most famous goal in Northern Ireland's history. I think you have to say that. And Jerry Armstrong put Northern Ireland 1-0 up, but this was just the start of the second half. There was another 43 minutes to go. And it was going to be a long, long, long second half, because Spain were sure to come at them. And boy, did they come at them. Jerry Armstrong actually was looking around, because the stadium had gone totally silent. And he thought, has it been disallowed or something? But then he saw Billy Hamilton celebrating, and then they went off. And there were about 3,000 Northern Ireland fans in the crowd. But actually, no, I have some friends who were there, and they were actually scattered around the stadium. So they were all over the stadium. There wasn't really a pocket of fans or a group of fans together. So any celebrations, etc., were hard to hear. What a goal, what a moment to celebrate. And for the 3,000 Northern Ireland fans that were there, what a night. So, but it got a lot tougher. I mean, Mal Donaghy, who had been an incredibly talented defender playing at left back and someone who had impressed, he got sent off rather harshly with half an hour to go. So suddenly you were up against the hosts, you were a goal up trying to hang on. You had only 10 men, but somehow Northern Ireland did survive some incredible performances. I mean, if you look at the lineup the lineup didn't change that much from many of the games. Pat Jennings in goal, Jimmy Nicol and Mal Donaghy were the full backs, Chris Nicol, John McClelland in the central defenders. You had Martin O'Neill, you had Sammy McIlroy, you had David McCreary in midfield, Norman Whiteside, Billy Hamilton and Jerry Armstrong up front. I mean, that was the 11 that started. The subs that came on that day were Sammy Nelson and Tommy Cassidy. We had actually talked about the experiment, so probably should have maybe mentioned that the only one of the three that played against Scotland, Jim Cleary, Bobby Campbell and Felix Healy, to actually play in the World Cup, was Felix Healy, who came off the bench against Honduras. Bobby Campbell and Jim Cleary did get to go to Spain, but actually didn't see any action. But that was the 11 players and the two subs that were the heroes that night for Northern Ireland on, I think without doubt, their greatest ever night.
Oh, 100%. It's an extraordinary result. And, you know, we talked about it in the last podcast as well, but the resilience of the team to understand, you know, that the place that they were in, the position that they were in, and that sometimes you just got to put backs to the wall, and you got to fight for everything that you've got, and they certainly did that.
Yeah, it was backs to the wall. I mean, it was the Alamo. It was certainly they didn't attack too much that I can remember. I mean, I remember being on the edge of the seat watching it at home on TV, and it was an incredible performance, and it felt like the final whistle was never coming, but eventually it did. And what a performance, and 13 heroes that night for Northern Ireland.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and as we mentioned, probably one of the greatest results in World Cup history, not alone in Northern Ireland history. An extraordinary evening for them in Valencia. And as well, it's interesting that you noted that sometimes the crowd can can be a hindrance too, as all the air got sucked out of the stadium for that Gerry Armstrong goal too.
Yeah, well, I mean, it had been said, actually, that Spain were feeling the pressure. And even if you go back before even Northern Ireland kicked the ball against Yugoslavia, I think it was Martin O'Neill had made the point that Spain will be feeling the pressure. I mean, Martin at this stage would have won a couple of European Cups and won the league with Nottingham Forest. So he would have been one of the bigger names, and he was obviously the captain as well. He was one of the bigger names in the squad. And Northern Ireland didn't have any pressure. There was no expectations. Spain, the hosts, and even after this tournament, there was certainly a feeling for a long, long time that Spain underperformed at major tournaments. And now, obviously, that's ridiculous to be saying that now when you look at the tournaments they've won and obviously the reigning European champions, they won the World Cup in 2010, etc. But even into the 80s, into the 90s, Spain underperformed. They didn't do themselves justice. In 86, they had a very impressive win. I remember Butragueño being superb, but then I think went out in penalties. 1990 went out to a very talented Yugoslavia side. 94, they flopped again. 98, they flopped. So there's kind of a history of Spain not doing themselves justice. They went out to Korea, and I appreciate there was some very dubious refereeing in that Korea game in 2002. But having put the Republic of Ireland out in the last 16, but there was a feeling that Spain had underperformed at major tournaments, hadn't done themselves justice. They had won the Euros and home soil in 64, but apart from that, certainly there would have been a lot of pressure on them as hosts. They would have been expected to perform, and there wasn't a culture of winning tournaments in Spanish football that there is today. I mean, if you're talking about potential winners next year in the World Cup, Spain would probably be top of most people's lists.
I think just to digress from the 82 World Cup, certainly since I was growing up watching football, they were always considered the dark horses. In other words, if they actually put it together, you know, in a major tournament, they could actually win the tournament. The problem was they just never did. And I think when that World Cup where they won it in, what, 2010, was it? Was probably the first time they actually went into World Cup as genuine, like, hot favourites to actually take on and bring home the World Cup because of the talent and the unbelievable talent that they had in that team. So, yeah, I kind of get it. I can see it in that. And, you know, in this game as well against Northern Ireland, I'm actually kind of surprised that they didn't get a penalty, because they'd gotten a penalty in each of the games beforehand as well. So maybe that kind of hometown bias was there. So we're not casting any aspersions on referees, but there is sometimes, especially if you're the host of a tournament, there is a little bit of hometown bias too, because the tournament kind of does better when the host does better.
Yeah, especially in those days, there was suspicion. And certainly in 78, there are strong feelings that, Brazil certainly felt cheated by Argentina in 78, but that there was a hometown bias. I should say in 1974, and maybe you go back to the mark of the man and Jack Taylor, the referee, an excellent, top-class, top-quality referee from England. And in the very first minute of the 1974 World Cup, he had the cojones, or whatever you say, to give a penalty against the host, West Germany, in the final. He gave a penalty to the Dutch. It was a penalty, but not many referees would have given a penalty against the hosts in a World Cup final in the very first minute. So that was an incredibly brave decision.
So Northern Ireland then move on to the next group phase, I suppose we'll call it. They finished top of the group as well, which would have surprised everybody.
Yeah, they won the group on 4 points, 2 points for a win in those days, with Spain edging out Yugoslavia on goal difference. That's actually on goals scored. Spain had a goals 3-4 and 3 against, whereas Yugoslavia had 2-2. So I should actually mention, I mentioned about the games not kicking off at the same time, because it was another group that actually caused this to happen. And what actually happened was Algeria, we talked about great shocks. Algeria opened their World Cup by beating West Germany. But they subsequently lost Austria and beat Chile. And but because they had finished, the last game of the group was West Germany-Austria. As it transpired, if West Germany won the game 1-0, both teams would progress to the next round. Now, it's still a shameful day in the history of German and Austrian football, because Germany, if I remember, they took, I mean, I was watching it on TV and it was, well, it was a travesty. Germany took an early lead through Horst Trubesch. They basically played out the 1-0 game. It's known as the shame of Gihon. It's the Germans don't sugarcoat it. They're embarrassed by it. And the Austrians as well. And it finished 1-0 to Germany. It was an awful game. They just kicked the ball around. And Germany and Austria went through. Algeria missed out on goal difference. And after that, FIFA had no choice but to make sure the last games in the group kicked off at the same time.
Oh, so it's because of that specific game?
It is generally thought of being of that specific game. I think it's probably fair comment. There was huge controversy at the time. I don't know if it's ever officially stated it's because of that game, but certainly after this tournament, the final games in the group always kicked off at the same time. And it's unthinkable today that you could have that situation happening again.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I'd imagine it was just embarrassing for the tournament as a whole, for FIFA, to have a game like that played at a major tournament. And that was probably the, I suppose, the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of that argument as well. So, and so we move on to the second group phase. Who does Northern Ireland have to face here?
Well, Northern Ireland ended up... they did get to avoid the West Germany and England group, which Spain were hoping to avoid. So Spain ended up in that group. So Northern Ireland ended up in a group with France and Austria. France had actually been runners-up to England, and Austria had been runners-up in that infamous group with Germany. So Northern Ireland were actually the only group winners in that group. Oh. It had been set up nicely for Spain that they would face two runners-up. But they weren't able to hold up their end of the bargain. It was Northern Ireland, Austria. Now, the way the group panned out, Austria got to play France first. So Northern Ireland had to wait. And obviously then you had a few days. So they had almost a week. They had a week between games because Austria played France. All three games were played in Madrid in the Vicente Calderon, the old Atletico Madrid stadium. Mm-hmm. And France beat Austria on the opening evening, 1-0, a goal from Gengini. So then it was Austria, Northern Ireland. Well, it was definitely going to eliminate Austria unless they won. And it was probably certainly a game Northern Ireland needed a result. Again, it was another superb performance. Billy Hamilton gave Northern Ireland the first half lead, a fully deserved lead. Austria did come out, they made a couple of changes at halftime, and they scored twice in the first half of the second half to equalise and then take the lead. But Northern Ireland came back and finished the fitter side. And Billy Hamilton again equalised with 15 minutes to go. And that was seen as being a very credible result, a very impressive result. That would have set up a winner-take-all against France. Well, France needing a draw and Northern Ireland needing a win to go through.
Yeah, and realistically, if there's only one team going through, you would have said that Austria or Northern Ireland, that was the kind of must-win game, though, wasn't it? I mean, for one of them to... If you had any real hope of getting out of the group, that was the game to do it realistically.
Yeah, I suppose realistically it would have been a better chance of beating Austria and drawing with France. But at least by getting the draw, Northern Ireland did keep it alive until the last day. I should actually mention that After the Spain game, basically excitement had reached absolute fever pitch back home in Belfast. They were the whole place had gone absolutely mad. It was on the front page of the newspaper as well as on the back page. They did do some things like cross-community. Norman Whiteside's mother from the Shankill and Jerry Armstrong's mother from the Falls were actually brought together, and they were photographed together, and they watched one of the games together. Oh, and there was the sad story of Jerry. Well, that was not too sad, but Jerry's young sister, Grania, was meant to be in Spain to watch the World Cup, but she unfortunately broke her legs, so she had to watch the World Cup at home in Belfast. But she did miss out on all the excitement.
One of the great regrets, I'd imagine.
I imagine so. It would have been pretty special to have been there.
Because we've kind of mentioned that there's a bit of a difference between in Republic-wise between 88 and 90, because 90 is the one that really grabs the nation's attention. Is this tournament, is it similar here? Is this one for the football fans, and then the next World Cups are for the nation, or is this capture everybody in Northern Ireland? Everybody in Northern Ireland is through the roof for this.
No, I think this had captured everybody in Northern Ireland, particularly after the win over Spain. I mean, there were street parties, everybody was watching. It was, they interviewed people in the Belfast Telegraph from all ages and all walks of life, and young women were given opinions on refereeing, on players, etc. So it certainly gave the impression that everybody was actually, the only downer was from the Reverend Ian Paisley, who wasn't too happy that the deciding game against France was going to be played on the Sabbath day, and he felt they were desecrating the Sabbath, but it didn't seem to bother too many others. And
run into the pubs in their Saturday or their Sunday best, I'd imagine.
So
they have to play France. They had already played France earlier in the year. They'd gotten a bit of a hiding by them, and they have to go to Madrid and play them. It's fair to say the dream kind of ends, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it was, as we said, a very talented French side. There was some controversy as well, and there still is, even though the final result was 4-1 and sounds like a right hammering. After 29 minutes, Martin O'Neill had a goal chalked off for offside that, well, he maintains was definitely onside. And it's certainly, if you look at the video evidence, it's a very tight decision. Who knows, had that goal been allowed, Northern Ireland would have gone one up. And they are, like they did against Spain, they were able to do backs to the wall to defend. Instead, France took the lead a few minutes later through Alan Jarrez. And the problem with that Northern Ireland team that Billy had built, they weren't really designed to chase a game. Now, you're 1-0 down to France, you need to win the game. Billy didn't have much choice. They did chase the game. They did open up in the second half, and they were picked off. I mean, as I said, it was a very talented French team. Dominic Rocheteau scored a couple of goals. Jerry Armstrong got one back. And that's another story that maybe is, I wouldn't say controversial, but possibly Billy Hamilton has been denied the chance to be Northern Ireland's leading goal scorer in a World Cup. But the official line is Jerry Armstrong got one back, but Jarrez made it 4-1 quickly afterwards. The reason I say it's a little bit, Billy basically claims he got a touch. So if you look at the video, the ball comes to Jerry Armstrong, the right-hand side of the box, and he drives the ball into the net. Now, Billy does a little jump and a flick. The TV at the time gave it to Jerry Armstrong. Malcolm Brody, the story goes that I've been told, and I think Billy tells, is that Malcolm Brody arrived down in the dressing room commiserating with the players, and they basically had said it was Billy's goal. And Malcolm said, well, I've already filed my report. It's gone back for tomorrow's telly, and I've given it to Jerry. And I said, okay, we'll say it was Jerry's goal then. Now, I've actually watched it a few times to see. I can't see a flick. I can't see the ball changing direction. So maybe it's one for Jerry and Billy to, I know they're good friends, and they can agree amongst themselves.
It's not like a forward to try and claim a goal from anywhere, though, is it?
No, so anyway.
But if we just talk about that, I mean, like I know on paper it's 4-1, and the other side of it too is this is an extremely talented French team filled with Gengini, Giresse, Platini, Tiganao, Rocheteau. Like these are top class players. Do you know what I mean? So there's also 4-1's not good, but there's also no shame in it either in terms of losing to a team that's so stacked and so filled with great players.
Oh, no, there's absolutely no shame to it. And I mean, Northern Ireland probably had no choice but to go for it. I mean, there was no point in defending and losing 1-0. You were going home anyway, so you had nothing to lose. Give it a shot, give it a try. And unfortunately, they got picked off by the French. They did open up. But as you say, what a talented French team. And they have their own what-onlys and what-ifs. Yeah. From the semi-final of that World Cup, which is another night of infamy and everything. But
I mean, like when you mentioned chasing the game, like they had chased the game against Austria and gotten a result. They were 2-1 down and they made it 2-2. So that they kind of, obviously Austria wasn't the same caliber as this French team. But, you know, the Northern Ireland showed that they could kind of go back and you know, perhaps with a team that's less talented and get the result from that point of view. But it shows the talent of this French side that when they went to chase this game against France, they just kind of basically passed them around and passed them through it and racked up the goals.
That's probably it. It was just they met a really, really top side at the top of their game. And a side that may well, could have well have won that World Cup. Well, apart from a very disappointing and a poor refereeing decision in Seville in the semi-final.
Yeah, absolutely. That turned into what could only be described as an assault that got no punishment.
Yeah, and I mean, it should have been a red card. I think it was outside the box, if I remember correctly. But
quick word as well on the final. A wonderful day for Italian football as well, and taking it against West Germany.
Yeah, and I mean, probably to mention one of the games, one of the greatest World Cup games of all time. A team we didn't talk about was the 1982 Brazil side, who were probably one of the best teams never to win the World Cup. But on a fantastic afternoon in Barcelona in the old Espanyol Stadium, Italy beat them 3-2. With a fantastic hat-trick from Paolo Rossi. That's in right, epic, an absolutely epic World Cup game. And what a game it was. So Italy, they get to they win the group ahead of Brazil and Argentina. They beat Poland in the semi-final, and they get to play West Germany in the final. And deserving winners. I mean, they won 3-1. It was a brilliant Italian side. Dino's off, the old and the young, Paolo Maldini, Paolo Rossi, Marco Tardelli, Alessandro Altobelli. What a team it was. I can still remember the Tardelli celebrations from he got the second and the clinching goal. Italy won 3-1, fantastic Italian side. And it was a very memorable World Cup. And I suppose the only, a disappointment from my point of view was a few weeks after the tournament, my father was a good friend of Tony Brazel, who ran Limerick Travel. And he was chatting to him and he said, had you a good summer? And he said, no, he said, I had trips to the World Cup final already paid for and I couldn't sell them. And I was, so I lost money. They went unused.
What?
And he says, And he says, why didn't you ring me? He says, I would have brought my sons. And no. I'm listening to this thinking, I could have been at the World Cup final, but...
crying tears. I'd be crying tears.
It wasn't to be. It wasn't to be. So that's... I did get to see it on TV.
Absolutely, so. But you would go on and see World Cup finals later on. So that wasn't all bad. But if we return to Northern Ireland, though, it really is. It's up there with 58, isn't it? This World Cup, simply because of that Spain result. Nobody expected him to get anything. Nobody expected him to do anything, and yet here they go ahead and they topped a group in an incredible victory.
Yeah, and I mean, you can, I'm not going to get involved in the arguments. You can make the argument was the 58 team better. They got to the quarterfinals, whereas in 82 was the last 12. They both got out of the group. They both had some incredible results. Both sides had some incredible top quality players. And I mean, I think all you can do is celebrate both and say both were fantastic achievements. And both will go down in history.
And to do it with I suppose a football team that doesn't have a big, huge, wide berth of players to choose from either, and that's why we talked about in the podcast before that the ability of Northern Ireland to create and bring these World Cup. Or sorry, these world-class footballers and these brilliant footballers and to develop them and turn them into fantastic players. And I think 82 is one of those really good examples of that, as well as 58. Do you know that they could kind of put it all together on the international stage as well as having these kind of the backbone of some really, really great players that they often produced?
And it should be said, you're absolutely right in everything you said, that at the time, Northern Ireland were the smallest country to ever play in a World Cup. They've since lost that record, but I think it's Trinidad and Tobago now. But it's incredible to have so many players and to produce so many quality players. And I mean, a lot of those names will still trip off the tongue. I mean, Pat Jennings, arguably one of the greatest goalkeepers of all time. Jimmy Nicol, what a player. David McCreary, Sammy McElroy, Martin O'Neill, Billy Hamilton, Jerry Armstrong, Norman Whiteside, what a player he was. And then you get the one what if and the if onlys. And I know I talked about France and everything. You have a name like George Best, and there was people saying maybe he could still have gone to the World Cup. But what age would George have been there then? Maybe about 35 or so. If things hadn't gone the way they went, if you had George Best, players were still playing at that the highest level in those days. If you had a George Best,
and obviously I don't know him, but judging by what we've kind of talked about so far, Billy kind of needed those players that he absolutely could trust, that he absolutely knew would do what he told them, stick to the game plan, you know, do the right things, etc. And I think perhaps Best was probably too much of a wild card in terms of his off the field things to maybe bring to a major tournament like that. And so perhaps that kind of made up Billy's mind in terms of bringing him to a World Cup and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I think, given where George was at and he hadn't been at the highest level, though there had been some people clamoring to bring him, I think it was the right decision not to bring him. He hadn't played for Northern Ireland for quite some time before that. But I suppose where I'm coming from is if George hadn't left Man United, I mean, he effectively left top-flight football, top-level football around 26. I know he went on and played for Fulham and Hibs and all that and played in America, but it wasn't top-level. I mean, he was arguably one of the greatest players in the world of all time, and certainly in his day. And if he had stayed at Man United, I mean, if the supports that were there today were there in those days to deal with the alcoholism, etc. If you had a George Best at 35, even to come off the bench for 20 minutes, if you're chasing a game against France, who knows? Look, we can talk. It's maybe a debate for a pub or something like that. I think
what you're saying is George might have given you that one moment of magic, not necessarily in maybe scoring a goal, but that phenomenal pass as well that could have created that one moment that could have changed a game from a draw to a win.
Yeah, and I mean, and I would have to say it would have had to be the George Best that would have had to have stayed playing at the top level of English football, not the George Best that was playing for Fulham. I don't know where he was at that stage, but I mean, he was playing for Tobermore United, I think. He played for Tobermore United. His last competitive game was in the Irish Cup. I think that was 1983 or 84. So not too long after the 82 World Cup, he was playing for Tobermore United, and I think they lost 7-0 to Ballymena. Might have got the score slightly wrong, but George Best's last competitive game of football was sadly for Tobermore United. You know,
absolutely, yeah. That is a podcast for another day. I think talking about the life and times and skill and the angels and demons, I suppose, of George Best and in his career. You could have an entire podcast on that. It would be fantastic. So any of our Northern Ireland listeners, if you want to make a suggestion for somebody that might be a good person to come on and talk with us about the life of George Best, please do make that suggestion. But we're leaving Northern Ireland now on a wonderful high after a fantastic tournament. And if you sum it all up for us, how would you rate this 1982 World Cup Northern Ireland team?
Look, it's probably the peak. We'll go on and talk about the rest of Billy's career as Northern Ireland manager. It was certainly the peak of his managerial career. I mean, to go to a World Cup, to beat the host, to qualify for the second phase, I mean, it's in the argument. It's up there with 58 and the Billy Bingham player in Peter Doherty's side that got to the quarterfinals of the World Cup. They were two fantastic sides. Brilliant days for football in Northern Ireland. And what a performance to get to the last 12, to miss out to a very, very talented French side that may well have gone on in one tournament if they'd had that little bit of luck or that refereeing call. Who knows? But certainly a wonderful tournament from Northern Ireland. And that team will go down in history. They'll be remembered forevermore.
Absolutely, yeah. Immortalised after a fantastic, fantastic tournament as well. Gary, as ever, thanks for delving with us in detail into another fantastic moment in footballing history for this island, this time up north and in Northern Ireland as well. So thanks once again for that.
Cheers, Kevin.
Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our resident football historian and fan, Gary Spain. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so you can get notified straight away when a new podcast drops. And remember, support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League teams. It's our history. It's our game. Bye for now.